I am Plato on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the highly anticipated novels of the season is the latest from the award-winning novelist Anne-Marie MacDonald. Adult Onset is described as a powerful drama about families, motherhood, memory, the past, and more. I'll get Ms. MacDonald, who joins me now, to tell us more. Anne-Marie MacDonald is the acclaimed author of best-selling novels Fall on Your Knees, which was shortlisted for the Giller Prize, and The Way the Crow Flies. She's also an actor, playwright, and broadcaster, the host of CBC's Doc Zone. The website for more is at annemariemacdonald.com. This book is published by Knopf. She will be participating in two events for this year's Vancouver Writers Festival, October 21st and 25th, wherever I checked, and they're already sold out. Please welcome to the Plato Online program Anne-Marie MacDonald. Ms. MacDonald, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been to the Writers Festival here in Vancouver before, haven't you?
I have, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that must be cool that you're part of two events and they're sold out.
It's very cool.
Yeah, there's also a fundraiser that you and Joseph Boyden are doing that I understand. It's at Vidge's, so if you want to have dinner with you and Joe, but yours is already sold out, isn't it?
Your
table.
So.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I would pay money to sit next to Joe Boyden at dinner. I'm halfway through the Orenda. It's so good.
Yeah, yeah. Who is Mary Rose McKinnon?
She is a 40-something married lesbian with two very young children who lives in a leafy, downtown, kind of shabby chic neighborhood, Toronto.
And I guess the question on this book tour that you're getting frequently, I'm sure, is how much of your life is in this book, and
as much as I could shovel into it by the wheelbarrow load and compress into one hairy week.
You're I guess taking that rule, write what you know to bear, aren't you?
I always have, and my books are all autobiographical. This one just happens to not have a period setting, lights and costumes to it.
Yeah, and I mean, what do you get out of writing, say, something that is...
I get out of a personal hell called my own psychic jail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I get out of.
Yeah, and do you find that it helps? Like, I mean, is the next week better, say, because you've written about 1 week, say?
I hope so. I mean, I write what I feel like I have to write. I bear witness to something. It has to feel authentic to me first before I will put it out into the world. And that moment, or an extended period of recognition, which we can, you know, shorthandedly call a moment, when I understand that this is the authentic thing, whether I like it or not, whether it scares the hell out of me or not, that's the thing I'm doing. And that's when I start to bring to bear my craft and to structure it and contain it and create the structure, which is fiction, that can hold the truth. That all sounds very esoteric, and I'm sorry, but it is, especially in the moments where the idea is just starting to make itself heard. And then it's my job to make it communicable, recognizable as a story, something that can be articulated and shared and no longer belong to me but belong to anybody who reads the book and who then talks about it with their friend, and then it no longer has anything to do with me. It's an it.
Now, a lot of authors that I talk to, whether they write fiction or memoirs, say that the actual process of committing words to paper, writing about it, has helped them in their life.
Yes, the truth will set you free.
Does it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. You know, but it's not like, oh, I've written these three books. They've all been actually intensely personal. And that's where we find the universal, in the specific. You can't extrapolate. People can't find themselves in a sort of a generalized story. If I, as an author, write something that I think everybody's going to relate to, I'll end up with a generalized kind of mush. I have to write very specifically and very personally and see where that takes me. And only then do you tunnel through to the universal, right? But it's not like I write something and then I feel so much better. Not at all. I just work so bloody hard, and I'm so grateful when I can say, I think this is done. And then I only feel free and, you know, quote-unquote better when I know that the book is a book. It has a life. It is being filtered through other people's points of view. It is becoming part of their autobiography and being changed in the process. That's when I feel good. And I feel like that when I'm an actor. You know, it's one thing to go through a rehearsal process, but you don't know what you've got until it's in front of an audience. And same with being a playwright. It does not, the work does not exist until it is shared, until it is communicated. Because I'm, you know, art for me is communication. And if I can't articulate it and share it and give it away, then it ain't art.
Now, once the book is published, though, other than talking about it on a book tour, you don't really go back to it, do you? Did you read it again?
No, I've never read any of my books, but I'm thinking at this point, I realized two things when I was approaching the finish line on this book. One was I understood that I was writing about myself in a parallel universe, a self who writes, who is struggling to write the third in a trilogy set in a parallel universe featuring a parallel self of her own. So once I'd got caught in that little psychic hall of mirrors, I felt better because I had some distance, and I could really charge ahead with the story. The other thing I understood was the little elves and puckish demons of my own psyche, little mischievous elves of my own psyche, had played a trick on myself, because I realized that I was writing the third in my own trilogy, and I hadn't understood that until I was just about finished writing this book, that it actually is the third in a trilogy. Because, okay, I'm going to geek out on my own work right now. Mm-hmm. Fall on Your Knees opens in 1899, closes with an epilogue in the early 1960s. The Way the Crow Flies opens in the early 1960s, closes in the first decade of the 21st century, which is where this book is set. This is set in 1 week, around, like, maybe it's like 2011 or something like that, 2012, whatever. It's here and now, but I thought, I've been sneaking up on myself. I have just completed the third in a trilogy.
Yeah.
Like, how is that? It's funny, but just when I think I'm completely self-aware, something like that happens, and I go, you know what, my neocortex is awesome, but it is not the boss.
Hmm. Now, in the book, we get Mary Rose, Mr. M.R., we get into her life and what's in her head. She seems rather discombobulated. Were you like that while you were writing?
Yes. Yeah, there was a parallel process. I was pretty fresh from the toddler trenches myself, mm-hmm. and my youngest had turned 5 by the time I started writing what would become adult onset. So, yeah, I was fresh from the fog of war. And I thought, before this becomes a hazy, rose-colored blur, I'm going to get right into it and write it. And also, you know, both my kids were in school for a full day, so they could withstand a degree of psychic abandonment that's necessary for their parent to write a novel between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 3 p.m. And also during that band of time, I had to do everything else that had to be done while they were not, you know, in the house. As well, I was writing with a condition which is very common contemporary condition called chronic sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
And by the time I went to my desk every day to work on this book, I had already been up and at 'em for like 3.5-4 hours. And a lot of people can relate to that, too. So I was thinking, rather than bemoaning all of this and considering it to be something I have to fight through and write in spite of, I thought, I'm going to just, you know, I'm going to plow all of this into this book, and that this book will be a product of the stuff that it's talking about.
Yeah,
I'm going to use it.
And the book opens with this email that Mary Rose gets from her father, from mm-hmm. her parents, that says what? Because I think it's also indicative of the relationship, isn't
it? Well, her father, her elderly father, is sending her an email to tell her he just watched the video It Gets Better.
It's his first email, though, right?
Yes, it's his very first email, because he is new to email, and he's new to the digital age, and he's keeping up, and he's 80-something, and he's terrific. And so is Mary Rose's mother. And the two, her two elderly parents have just watched the It Gets Better video. And he has emailed to tell her how happy they were to see that and how proud they are of their lesbian daughter and her wife. And Mr. gets this email and just thinks, wow, my parents really are just the sweetest, nicest, bestest in the world. But she can't quite formulate a fitting reply to her father's email. And the whole book really is a process of unraveling and re-raveling to the point where she can actually figure out what it is she has to say in reply to that email. Because even though things are hunky-dory now between her and her parents, they were actually pretty hellish back in the day when she first came out. And she had never really faced that or processed it. And, you know, if you have small children and you haven't processed some of your own stuff, it will spring up demon-like when you least expect it. And that's what she finds out. She finds out that she's actually not completely in charge of herself. So how could she be completely in charge of her children? And having gone about she's gone about child-proofing her whole house, you know, to make her kids really safe. But what she has not done is mother-proofed it. And that's what she's faced with having to do. Because she realizes, holy crap, my kids are not going to fracture their skull on the edge of the coffee table. They're not going to be in danger from any unprotected AC outlets in my house. The thing that they are in danger of is their mother, namely me, Mary Rose. She's the most dangerous thing in her kids' lives.
Yeah, and spoiler alert, because I've read an excerpt of a speech that you gave, I guess it was the law school at Upper Canada College, is
that
right?
Yeah, the Law Society of Upper Canada.
Okay, yeah. And
for world pride.
Yeah, and so in reading that, that was in June, I guess. I read that in the Globe and Mail on the website. You got a similar email, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah.
I did, and imagine my surprise when I found myself, after having already written probably over 1,000 pages toward what would ultimately become this novel, coming to that. Because I had actually written it down in a notebook, and I went back and I looked it up, and I thought, yeah, that's where this story begins. This is the inciting incident in the drama that's going to unfold over the course of 1 week.
Yeah, and
so I did reproduce a version of that, and that's where Mary Rose's week begins. Then that's where her unraveling begins.
And you know, we always talk about, you know, a lot of us, I guess, feel that if we bury the past, if we suppress certain bad memories, that does it. You know, I mean, that'll fix everything that's wrong. But as we see in the book, in the course of this book, that doesn't really work, does it?
No, and, you know, many of us can relate. Like, at a certain point, you go, am I in denial or am I simply moving on? And do I have a healthy degree of optimism, or am I in a pathological state of denial?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know the difference, but there are certain signs. If you do find yourself at 3 a.m. Q-tipping the vinyl stripping around your fridge, the freezer drawer, that's one sign. If you find yourself grabbing your toddler and about to yank them with any degree of violence, that's another sign. there are these signs that, gee, maybe it's actually denial. Maybe I have to turn around and face this thing that's popping out at me, this demon.
Yeah, that's the other thing that struck me about the book is I mean, it's not the tedium, because it's a rather frenetic, and there's a lot that's happening in one's daily life, everyday life.
Yes, but it is indescribably tedious,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it is. You've sort of raised what one consider ordinary in one's life to something else. I mean, do you find even now that every day is a shitstorm?
No, it's different. My children are older.
Ah, I see.
So it's a little more channeled and focused, and it's a little bit less unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, when I read reviews of this book, and thus far the reviews have been pretty good, haven't they?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, a few of the reviewers have talked about how the book relates to them, and you've already touched on this earlier about how the book is now out, and it now has a life of its own. What does it feel like when people say to you that this book has meant a great deal to them, that they saw their story in it?
I feel like it's opened up right in their hearts. That's how I feel. I go, wow, this is that is, I guess I feel a tremendous sense of relief that it has found an answer, you know? It's found a home. It's opened up inside. It has unfolded in somebody else, and it is now theirs, and they get it. And it belongs to them now. It's not just mine, and it's wonderful, because it can be very isolating to spend such a long time with one piece of writing, especially a piece of writing for which one is drawing on, you know, darker aspects of one's own experience. That's a big, you know, it is a big risk to do that. And so to have other people go, hey, that's me too. In my own way, I get that. That's really heartening.
And it's different kinds of reviewers. It's not just women. I mean,
no, there's a lot of guys.
Yeah, who get it.
Yeah, and that's, it's got to be, art has to be transferable, right? It has to be, everybody has to be able to extrapolate on the specifics of the story and say, yeah, I know the specifics are different, but that's my story you've told.
Did you encounter readers impatient for the next book over the last 11 years, say?
Yes.
Yeah. And so how do you deal with that? I mean, it's a great deal of pressure, I'm assuming.
It is. I feel really grateful that I have readers who are waiting, and I feel almost debilitated by the pressure of expectation, in the sense that I think, oh my God, what if I disappoint everybody? You know, I'm human. I have the very ordinary fears. Like, hey, what if I never think of anything else that anybody wants to read again? You know, that's really scary. But it's a privilege all at the same time.
Do people ask you why you don't, say, write a memoir or an autobiography?
Yes, they do. Well, the simple answer is that I'm not a memoirist. I love reading memoirs, and I know the difference. This is a story. This is a compressed 1 week in the life. It is. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And stuff happens that never happened to me. And it's just, it's not. I'm not a memoirist. I am not one of those people. That's a different art form. My art form is storytelling.
Do you think you're able to do something in fiction that you couldn't do in another form of writing?
Yes, I can be way more truthful in fiction.
Really?
Yeah. I get so impatient with myself. If it were a memoir, I go, what? How boring. No, let me tell you a story. I got to make something up. I have to make fictional containers in order to convey truth.
Do you worry that writing about oneself perhaps is exploitative of one's life?
Yeah, I've worried. Well, I've worried about injuring people whom I love, you know, people in my family, my parents, and all of that. And I've taken steps to be very honest with them about whatever it is that I'm working on. And not just with this book, but with the previous books as well. And, the fear of, there's all kinds of fear, but those are all elaborate forms of procrastination. And every writer suffers from and is tempted by all kinds of reasons to procrastinate. And you have to soldier through, and it takes a lot of stamina. It just takes a lot of stamina to stick with something when you feel like you're going to risk all of that exposure. But it is really, really, really scary.
Yeah. But digressing dramatically here, I've been a big fan of your work on television. I mean, I watch you regularly.
Thank you.
Going back to Life and Times
and now
Doc Zone. Well, when you do those, I'm assuming you do, you don't go in once a week and tape it, do you?
Or, no.
Yeah, so you
no.
do a bunch, say.
We do clusters, yep.
Yeah, because I always wonder, do you stand there, do the intro, and then do you stand there watching the thing and then come back and do the end part? Or?
No, I narrate them in a separate place, at a separate time and place.
Yeah.
And we just tape all of the introductions all in a row.
What's it like when you travel the country? Because there are people that know you from TV, and then there are people that know you from the novels, that know you as an actor, say.
Yeah.
I mean, it must be gratifying, but it must be also interesting to see how people know you.
Yeah, there are these different avenues, right? And what I've observed, number one, I'm lucky to have those different avenues of approach. And what I what I have found is that people are really actually quite happy to approach me. I'm very approachable. And I think it's probably lucky because sometimes I think my work is, you know, is scary and people feel very private about ways in which it's touched them sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm pretty, yeah, as I say, I'm approachable. I like meeting readers. And I feel really lucky when I get to come out and do the festivals, etc., because I actually get to engage with the real people who read my books. And it's so much less lonely than writing them.
I just realized, because I hadn't read your previous books, and I remember when the first book came out, I was like, hey, that's a lady from TV. and then now that I've read, have started to read this one, Adult Onset, it's like I know you better.
Yeah. You know what people do? If they see you on TV or whatever, they do feel like they know you. And that is something I've experienced. But to be perfectly honest, people often think they already know me. I just have an aura of familiarity. I have one of those familiar faces. Ever since I was a kid, I always looked like somebody in somebody's family.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And I sort of thought, well, that's good. That's just part of how I'm going through this world. And that is, it's a really good thing. If people think I'm familiar, then they're predisposed to be at ease and to trust me. And that's a real plus for a storyteller or an actor, is if that trust tends to be there between the artist and the audience. That's a very good thing.
Here's a cruel question. Will it be 11 years until the next book?
Oh, God, I hope not. Mm. Shouldn't be. Mm. Really, what would be my excuse?
do you have, like, are you working on something now? Do you have an idea, say, or?
Well, you know, I am lucky enough to be touring intensively, so I don't actually have time to think of anything consciously, which is not to say that there isn't an idea cooking back there in my subconscious. I can only hope that in the age of distraction in which we live, there are actual coherent ideas taking shape, unbeknownst to my conscious mind.
I'm really enjoying this book, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thanks for this, and congratulations, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks a lot, Joe. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
The website, AnneMarieMacDonald.com. The book is called Adult Onset. Do get it. It's a really engaging read. I'm finding it hard to put down. It's from Knopf. It's author Anne Marie MacDonald. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Lunter.